The beauty of Hold It for me is that it's a place of collaboration. It's a place of conversation. It's a place of dispute. I think disagreement is necessary. I think sometimes we here become too beholden to a narrow perspective. And so I encourage you to push each other as we talk about these texts today and tomorrow and Thursday. Second thing, obviously, Sharon mentioned this, that I'm in part doing a partial session because the completion of the session on bodies is going to be done by occasionally my wife, where you get to wrestle more directly with a lot of the issues that I hope at least what I'm going to be doing will bring up. So I encourage you to attend. So obviously we're talking about bodies, and because we're talking about bodies, I'd like everyone to just stand up. Like, get a stretch. Maybe touch your toes.
Yeah.
Scoliosis, so I've kind of popped my back. I've got a rib cage that pops out. This will be wonderful on the session tape, won't it? So as you're standing, what's your experience of your body? Wait, what?
Just thumbs up.
Yeah. Okay. Like, say more. What do you mean by thumbs up?
I like having one.
You like having a body? Okay.
I do all the stuff I want to do in the world.
Okay. Let you do all the stuff you want to do in the world. Great. Other thoughts?
Could be worse.
Could be worse. What do you mean?
That's what it needs to do, and I always wish it was better, but it's I'm delighted and feel thankful to have it.
Okay.
Function.
Other thoughts?
Parts of it hurt more now.
Your parts of it hurt more now. Yeah. Say more, Daisy.
I don't know what happened after 40, but
okay. So age.
Yeah.
Yeah. Other thoughts.
My left big toe hurts, but it's going to be okay. The doctor said yesterday.
Okay. There is something wrong with your left big toe.
Well, just don't take it easy on hikes. Don't hike as much as usual.
Okay. So watch out for the hiking. Okay. Other thoughts about your body?
It's a reminder of the journey. Yeah. Light journey we're on.
Okay, say more.
Well, the changes that take place, that some of which have been alluded to, as you get older, you need more medical intervention, and health becomes more and more on your mind all the time, and it's a reminder that things are different today than they were 60 years ago when I was born.
Okay. So your attitude or your experience of your body changes depending on your age. Other thoughts?
Gratitude.
Why?
Well, I get out of the shower, I look, and I got a zipper down here, and I only got one eye, and I'm going golfing, and I'm still here.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Good? Yay. Anyone else up there?
I was
just
gonna say, I often find my body is a source of wisdom for me.
Oh, say more.
Sometimes I find I get information about things I need to know or things I'm ignoring, things I'm not paying attention to from things that happen in my body. It kind of takes over the thinking brain.
Okay.
And that's something I've come to value.
That's impressive. Can you teach me? How many of you want to sit down now?
Sounds good.
Well, I could say, why don't we stand up the whole time? Would you be more aware of your body during the session if I make you stand up?
Yes.
Less aware of you.
Yeah. What do you mean? Sitting down and sleepy. You know. You can all stand up. How many of you find it easy to talk about your bodies? Peter does.
You do?
I do.
I don't. You know, I have scoliosis. I have a big hump. On my back.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there it is.
Right now I can feel it because I did yoga yesterday and I'm actually sore from yoga. I don't like to acknowledge that. I also don't, I'm a little sweaty, so I smell a little bit more than I probably do, even though I showered. Thanks, Dan. I mean, the thing about our bodies that I think are interesting from at least a Christian perspective is that we're not always comfortable talking about bodies, in part because we inherited a tradition that sort of stresses the spiritual, the soulful, and in many ways ignores the body, or has historically ignored the body. And that's been part of also gender issues, especially ignored women's bodies, the tradition. But those are some of the things I want to talk about. My intention today is to sort of talk about a couple things. There's a really influential book written maybe 6-7 years ago called A Secular Age by a philosopher named Charles Taylor. And among other things, he talks about something called a social imaginary. And the social imaginary suggests that all of us are creatures of our imagination. And because we're creatures of the imagination, all of us sort of put things together in our life in particular ways that we often don't realize. So today we're going to talk about two sort of Bible passages, but before we do that, I want us to pay attention to the social imaginary that has shaped us. And I've come up with a number of sort of different ideas of what I think our social imagination is around bodies. And I'm glad to open it up and we can talk more about that, but I also want to get to the text so that we can think about what the Bible story is telling us about bodies, in particular Christian bodies. So what are sort of some imaginative dimensions to our bodies? And first off, the contemporary bodily values, and I got this quote obviously from Matthew, "For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." That in our context, 1 out of every $6 spent in the U.S. is spent on healthcare. It's about 18% of U.S. GDP, or roughly about, what, $10,348 per person. This is from 2016, so the most recent. It's a lot of money that we spend on our lives. So despite the fact that we're all spiritualized people who care about our spirit and our soul, and I assume we do because we're in a place like Holden, that we also care deeply about our bodies. We also spent approximately $445 billion on healthcare products. Treasure. So that's one part of our imaginative frame when it comes to bodies. In particular, also in the Christian tradition, there's a couple other parts that I want to bring up. One, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who is sort of an important figure, shall we say. In his Ethics, writing at a time, obviously, when the Nazi state was attacking bodies, he wrote this. He wrote, the bodiliness that God has willed as a form of human existence becomes an end in itself. Then there is a right to bodily joys without subordinating them to a higher purpose. His point there is to say that our bodies themselves are where we experience joy, but they're not just a means to an end. Physical pleasure then itself is an end. Experiencing joy, experiencing happiness are all proper and dignified responses to our bodies. For him, obviously, he's also dealing again with a state that is seeing bodies as means, especially Jewish bodies or non-Aryan bodies. So I think that's with us too as bodies, that kind of notion that in our tradition we talked about the importance of our bodies, that they're not just means to an end. We're not just sort of renting them. They're good gifts of God. And I think Diane's session this morning really did a good job of talking about that with the image of God. Another dimension that I think is about my bodiness, and I got this from Being Mortal. Anyone read Being Mortal? So it's a terrific book about dying, and it really provoked me to rethink, as my parents are getting older, as my grandmother just passed away about 2 weeks ago, to think about how we do dying in this country. And his point, and I'll read it, his point is that in many ways, our culture says that this is my body. I'm a particular individual, and I get to decide what I get to do with my body. The challenge, though, as you get older, your body needs help. Your body needs a community. Your body needs people around you to help take care of it. And focusing on your body as a particular individual doesn't necessarily do that. So he's critical sort of this notion of individuality that we get in our culture. And he writes this in Being Mortal. The progress in medicine and public health has been an incredible boon. People get to live longer, healthier, more productive lives than ever before. Yet traveling along these altered paths, we regard living in the downhill stretches with a kind of embarrassment. And downhill stretches here, he's talking about when we start to get sick. And we start to need people. We start to need care. We start to need others. We need help, often for long periods of time, and regard that as a weakness rather than as the new normal and expected state of affairs. We're always trotting out some story of a 97-year-old who runs marathons, as if such cases were not miracles of biological luck, but reasonable expectations for all. Then, when our bodies fail to live up to this fantasy, we feel as if we somehow have something to apologize for. Those of us in medicine don't help, for we often regard the patient on the downhill as uninteresting, unless he or she has a discrete problem we can fix. Any responses to this? He's pushing us to recognize that we're social creatures, not just mere individuals. And in particular, as our bodies start to fail, which will happen to all of us, then why don't we have a culture that honors that? So, a good book, if you ever read it. Another aspect of our culture is something called transhumanism.
Yeah.
Transhumanism is the belief that sort of the next evolutionary step in human nature is to actually merge with technology. So for instance, one of the leading proponents of it is Ray Kurzweiler. He's the Kurzweiler keyboard. He's using all the money he made from inventing the Kurzweiler keyboard to try and invent some way to download his consciousness into a computer system so he can live immortally. So transhumanism, this is a definition of it. It is their belief, the transhumanists, that we can and should eradicate aging as a cause of death. That we can and should use technology to augment our bodies and our minds. That we can and should merge with machines, remaking ourselves finally in the image of our own higher ideal. This is a growing field. This is something that my children, I think, will probably have to wrestle with much more than I wrestle with, but it's there. Can we develop technology that we somehow get out of our body? Because really, we're not really bodies. We're some other kind of consciousness that doesn't need the body. So in many ways, it's actually a devaluation of the body.
Well, it certainly sees death as something hideous and
final.
Yeah, one final.
Final. So I think that's also in our imaginative frame. You have a question?
I just wonder if this isn't, if we look back a little further to when organ transplantation happened, if there isn't, if that wasn't part of this idea that we can avoid death by some other part or means or.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, part of it assumes that what we are is
the machine.
Yeah, we're just machines, yeah. And you replace the parts. I mean, I think the more involved I was a chaplain once with doctors for when I did CPD, and really respected a lot of doctors because a lot of them recognized the limits to medical technology. That we're not machines. Our bodies don't work that way. Yes.
Would it be correct to say that some people, another idea along that line would be we can and should eradicate the outcomes of aging as a cause of not death but discomfort?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because we do a lot of replacement of joints
mm-hmm.
now. And that wouldn't necessarily be the cause of death, but But we can do that, and so it's very common now to get your knees replaced or your hips replaced or lots of things replaced. And it's super common. I have a lot of friends who've been through all these operations. And does that not kind of move along a continuum about, yeah, we're kind of prolonging things all the time?
Sure. I think the other continuum, and I'm not sure this is what you're hinting at, is where does the line between sort of being human and being a bodily creature and being something else?
Yeah, that's
where
right.
Where is that line?
Yeah, I think that's how you're getting at what I'm sort of getting at.
I think going back to your Atul Gawande quote as well, he I think, would agree that living healthy as long as possible is something to strive for, but would also at the same time be critical of hope. Heroic efforts to prolong life, because a lot of those cost data you showed were end of life care.
Like 80% of the healthcare costs of a person's life are in the last 2 years. He also, in that book, he talks a lot about how his father died, right? Either his father or his grandfather. And he died at home. He died surrounded by his extended family, which is a very different vision of death than I think the way we tend to practice. My grandmother, like I said, she died about 3 weeks ago. She was 96. She had dementia. It was a good death, but my dad lives in Maryland. She lives in Wisconsin. One aunt lived in Iowa. One aunt lived in Illinois. And they all had to give up their lives for 3 weeks to go attend to her because she lived alone in an assisted living facility. And it really brought forth to me like the point of his argument that is that the way we want to approach death of people you care about? Other thoughts about transhumanism? It's a really interesting, transhumanism is really fascinating. It's really obscure. It's not sort of well developed. And you see lots of sort of Silicon Valley types talk about different techniques.
To me, the real ethical issue is how. What sort of disparities between rich and poor would something like this lead to?
Yeah.
This is not going to be democratized.
Right. Yeah.
Whatever gains come here, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. All kinds of other ethical issues. Social justice.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about the story my sister now tells. She's in her 60s and her heart stopped. She died. And then a machine that was inside her chest jolted her back into life. And so this thing that was inside her chest and she really didn't like, she didn't like having it, it felt like an imposition, was suddenly
crucial.
And she's now grateful for what it did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what does she say other than gratefulness? I mean, does she wrestle with these kinds of questions?
I don't think she wrestles now. I mean,
I think she's still processing. I think she does wrestle with it.
But in a very different way,
mm-hmm.
because of that
right.
event.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's a better way of saying it. Yeah.
Mm. I don't know. I see current trends going more in a direction of having technology replacing human roles in various activities and so on, rather than sort of an integration between humans and technology, but
so like self-driving cars, that kind of.
Well, yeah, I mean that's the technology, pure technology, I guess, can do more and more things, and that's definitely a very strong, direction that things are being developed, and that raises the question then, what is our role going to be when all these things are being done by technology.
Yeah. There's a wonderful essay, it's pretty short, by Wendell Berry. I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with him. It's called What Are People For?
Mm-hmm.
But I think it asks that very question. You know, if we replace all what humans do, vocationally speaking, with robots and whatnot, what are we for?
Right. Yes.
Another dimension to bodies in our context is the inequality of bodies. I took this from James Cone, who recently passed away, the black theologian. He wrote a book called The Cross and the Lynching Tree, where it compares African-American experience as Christians. Their experience of the cross really is of the lynching tree. That's the equivalent symbol. And he wrote, both Jesus and blacks were strange fruit. Theologically speaking, Jesus was the first lynchee who foreshadowed all the lynched black bodies on American soil. He was crucified by the same principalities and powers that lynched black people in America. Because God was present with Jesus on the cross and thereby refused to let Satan and death have the last word about meaning, God was also present at every lynching, not lynching. God saw what, spell check, God saw what whites did to innocent and helpless blacks and claimed their suffering as God's own. God transformed lynched black bodies into the re-crucified body of Christ. Every time a white mob lynched a black person, they lynched Jesus. The lynching tree is the cross in America. When American Christians realize that they can meet Jesus only in the crucified bodies in our midst, they will encounter the real scandal of the cross. And obviously, I don't think it's just black bodies, it's transgender bodies, it's women's bodies, it's immigrant bodies.
So why is our symbol an instrument of torture?
That's a good question.
What was the question?
Why is our symbol an instrument of torture? Oh. And the point here I'm trying to get at, though, is that our society doesn't treat bodies the same. Wealth, status, gender, sexuality, citizenship. We have many boundaries. And I think that does shape our consciousness of our bodies. Another view, and this comes from a Latino theologian, and her view is she describes bodies as we're all inscribed. And to get at this, I will share a story. If you look at my wrist here, you can't see, but there's a scar. And I can tell you a story about this scar. The scar actually comes from McDonald's. I used to work at McDonald's when I was in high school. And the top of the toasted buns, fell on my wrist and burnt me. Exciting, yeah. But can't all of you tell me a story about something that's happened to your body, a scar? Some of them are sort of accidental, like this one, but some of tattoos. That we inscribe, we write on our bodies and are written by society. I mean, I have a friend, too, who once shook my hands and said, Petter, you have really soft hands. Well, why do I have soft hands? Well, among other things, what do? I read books. I don't pick fruit. I don't work in a sawmill. My father-in-law was talking about having all 10 fingers after he finished working at the Holden sawmill. Our bodies are inscribed. The scars and the missing parts, the sun patches that we get. And Myra's sort of point here is that this world is a labyrinth of incarnations. Our bodies incarnate, our fleshiness. All of us have different ways we've navigated life that have shaped our particular body, our physical presence in particular ways. To be a body is then to be tied to the world, not beyond the specificities of our bodies, but through them. The visible traits of my body affect whether the world recognizes me and receives me or ignores me and wounds me. It constrains my actions, how I move or talk, What am I to look at, taste, explore? Social relations leave visible marks on our bodies. Gradually, societies may also shape the most fundamental elements of our corporate reality. Social norms are always becoming flesh. I was just thinking, my wedding band, if I take it off, you would probably still know I'm married because I have an indentation. I actually have calluses here in the wedding band. I'm married. But that's a social institution that has shaped what I do with my body in particular ways. And all of us are shaped by a society that has certain expectations and demands things of our bodies. So our bodies tell stories to others and to ourselves. And I think the importance then is, what story do we want to tell? Or what stories do we want to tell? Which brings us to sort of this last one. I'm a Kierkegaard scholar most days. And the Christian tradition, I think, what are the beauties of it, no matter what you think about Christ, for instance, is that it recognizes our in-betweenness. That there's something more, but there's still something now. It's now and not yet. Kierkegaard says, immortality cannot be a final alteration that crept in, so to speak, at the moment of death is the final stage. We as Christians believe that we are eternal, even right now in our fleshiness, in our incarnation. That's who we are created by God to be. On the contrary, it is a changelessness that is not altered by the passage of years. So we age, but we don't age. That betweenness, which gets us again, what story do we want to tell about our bodies as Christians? So these are some of the thoughts that I had in terms of the social imaginary that gets us to a place of some of the values that we place on our bodies and our culture. Anyone have anything else that they would add? These are certainly not exhaustive. Yeah.
Well, with genetic mutation nowadays, you know, I know that I have BRCA1, and that's passed on, and that's another thing in our bodies. We know that from the past, my great-grandma, you know, and in the future, my daughter.
Yeah. But how much of who we are is determined by our genetic makeup.
Right.
Good. Yeah.
I was reading Viktor Frankl this winter, and one of Tien's answered for me with the having been is the surest way of being, and it's really struck me. I lost my husband in the last year.
I'm sorry.
That just was really powerful for me.
So maybe one way to think of that too is the responsibility we have to be by being, the choices that we make, and that fair.
Yeah, and the memories and the presence doesn't go away.
Part of it goes back to often social standing. Mm-hmm. It's easy for some people who have resources to eat organic food all the time. But if you live in a food desert, for instance, it's hard. It's good. It's good. Anyone else? I'm glad to move on, but I think you do a little more work. Maybe make you move your body. So what I'm hoping to do with that frame is to then have you look at two texts and think about what they say about, in particular, what does it mean to be a Christian body? What's the story that God is asking us to tell through our bodies? So what I'd like you to do, and I'm going to make you move, because I'd like you to find people you do not know. Holden has a delightful way of forming bonds that last over time. But it's also important that we meet each other anew, literally. So try and find maybe two other people that you don't know. Introduce yourself. And I'd like, we'll spend maybe 10 minutes. What did you guys talk about? Yeah, that.
Well, one thing that has always struck me about that ending is that when Lazarus comes out of the tomb, he's described by the story as the dead man. The dead man comes out walking. He's still dead. He's physically moving, but he's still dead. He's wrapped in the clothes of death, and he's described as the dead man. And he needs the community, which is the body of Christ, really, to unwrap him and unbind him and let him go. And Jesus instructs and empowers the community to be the ones to help bring Lazarus life. And in some ways, this is as much a miracle of the Christian community and the community that Jesus is calling it to be, I think, as it is Jesus, you know, being the big power and zapping Lazarus. So to me, that we're Christian bodies living in this body of Christ in the world. And that story is so powerful for me as a story example of what that
looks like. That's beautiful. As the social, I'm not going to say this right, but we're all social creatures. How do I say that? Sociality?
It's a good word. Yeah.
Yeah, in verses 36 and 7, so the Jews said, see how he loved him, but some of them said, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying? And there was the expectation, you know, come on, Jesus, we would not have had to go through this. You know, so they're saying to Jesus, you could have, if you were not of, you could have saved us from not having to go through this man died.
So do you think that piggybacks with what Christine was saying, in some ways that maybe we can't expect God to do miracles, but on the other hand, we're a community that should support each other? And to nurture our bodies requires us to be a part of that community and not just to expect God to do it all.
Sure, yeah.
That grief is just part of this human story. Mm-hmm. There's no escaping that.
Yeah. Or it could have been that, you know, Jesus could have given a caveat, I think, and said, I can do this, but you may not like what comes out of it. Mm-hmm. You know, the guy's still stinking and he's still got the problems.
He's still healing.
He's worse off now than he was before. but guess what? You want it? Okay, there you are. You know, and maybe that was a good lesson for everybody. Like, whoa, we don't want that. We don't want that going on all the time. That doesn't make any sense whatsoever. I don't know. You don't hear the end of the story.
There are a number of Christian ethicists who deal with transhumanism in particular and basically ask the question, why would someone want to live forever? Because so much of our joy and life has to do with sort of the seasons of living.
Yes.
And the experience of, frankly, wisdom that comes with aging.
Right.
You know, I think a lot wiser, you could debate that with me, but today when I was...
We will ask her.
Yeah. Well, I could say I married her, that's the one.
I'm doing like the coffee break later in the week, so you can just come and ask.
Yeah, so an advanced healthcare directive, common question nowadays is, what's a good day for you?
So quality of life.
Yeah, it doesn't say what's a good quality day, but what's a good day, you know, for you? And so if you think about that, when I think about it, I think, well, after a certain amount of debilitation or, you know, things happening to me, I'm not so sure I would be having great days necessarily, because my powers of to enjoy living might be very curtailed. And so if that's the case, then, you know, don't start up my heart again when I'm already, don't make me into Lazarus, because I don't want to be here, you know, under certain circumstances. And I think that's a very appropriate question to ask oneself. It's like, why am I here? What do I enjoy about being here?
That's what came up in our group. We Shirley mentioned that there's no, Lazarus's choices are not in this story at all. And so the question of what does it mean to live in a Christian body, we are culturally and technologically now, we can make a lot of decisions ahead of time about what we want and control outcomes and say, oh, in this situation I want this, in this situation I want this. And Lazarus doesn't get any choices. God brings him to life. And it made me think of the sermon last night as well, that that image of being told to wake up and called as Christians to wake up to the bodies around us and our own bodies. And that in this story, it is not the choice of the individual who is awakened.
What do you do with them?
We have a lot of ways to sleep and die as well, right? Culturally now, I think more than have been available to people.
Yeah.
Historically and globally, we have all kinds of screens to look at and chemicals and substances to take. And so there are a lot of ways to die before dying, right, physically.
Yeah.
And so that calls you to wake up and come back to life is compelling.
Well said.
Nicely said.
Yeah,
nice.
Yeah.
Other thoughts?
How do I get a Christian body? That's a question to me. I have a Buddhist body, so
okay.
You know, if it's different, I'd like to try it. I don't know what it's like.
Well, it raises the question, is a Christian body any different than a Buddhist body? Or
I am presuming it is.
That's a great question. How about we shift to, what did I say, Mark 5, 21 to 34, which ironically, we didn't realize this is the text from last night. So, it's quite well. Mark 5, 21 to 34, so asking the same kind of questions, what pops up when you talk about this text in bodies? It's 5:21, Mark, not Luke.
So Jesus crossed again and spoke to the other side. A great crowd gathered around him. He was by the sea. One of the leaders of the synagogue, Jairus, came. Stella to Stephen begged him repeatedly, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well."
Did you guys look at following the order?
Oh, did most of you already look at Mark 5?
Yeah.
Mark 5.
Okay.
We did. Good. That's fine.
How about I wait for the two?
That's good. Okay. And a large crowd followed him and pressed in on him. Now there was a woman who had been suffering from hemorrhages for 12 years. She had endured much under many conditions and had spent all that she had, and she was no better, but rather no worse. She had heard about Jesus and came up behind him and grabbed him to his clothes, for she said, "If I but touch his clothes, I will be made whole." Immediately her hemorrhage stopped, and she felt in her body that she was healed of the disease. Immediately aware that power had gone forth from her, Jesus turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my clothes?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing in on you. How can you say, 'Who touched me?'" He looked all around to see who had done it. The woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling, fell down before him, and told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. And is it supposed to continue then through the end of the healing of Jairus' daughter? I cannot remember, but I thought it was maybe just in 34 that we're supposed to read. But then the story continues, and then he goes and heals Jairus' daughter. I thought the sermon last night was so fine. And thinking about this, Jesus is on the way to heal the daughter of this powerful man, and yet interrupted then by this unkind woman of no society.
Well, it's really twisted because
that's what I
know. It's a Greek Orthodox,
prevalent women? You said Greek Orthodox.
And of the health issue that is of women becoming sick and dying, and they're going to be in pain. I can't remember where they were.
So we have about 5 minutes left, so how about we bring it into the wider group conversation? So what struck you? I know you guys had something to say.
Just a different response with the crowd weeping with the story of Lazarus. And this one, he seems like kind of annoyed and puts him out of the house.
So what do you make of that difference?
You notice that the word weep appears time and again in the Lazarus story, and that Jesus eventually weeps with them. Here, the weeping is something going on, that he is a bit more judgmental of. Maybe because they're not getting the point that he just did this and he can do it.
So what do we make of that? You don't
know. I've always thought it strange that this story ends with the girl was 12 years of age. And I'm like, why do we need to know that particularly now? But then on this reading, I noticed that's the number of years the other woman had been hemorrhaging, and now I think there's a very specific link between these two healings, and I'm curious what the nature of that link could be.
I've thought about this story a lot, and it's not what you're talking about, but I'm gonna say it anyway. For at least in our kind of cultures today, 12 is the age of kind of puberty. It's the age you get your period, and I had an old Holden friend who had it, like basically a hemorrhage of blood, and she would be going like through 3 super pads an hour, and it's gross. So here's this woman, who's just like bleeding and bleeding, and maybe this little girl who's just getting her period. So I kind of wonder too what the connection is here. Sorry, Petter.
This is just, that's a great question.
This has just always been on my mind for a long time.
A great question.
I just wanted to say.
What is the connection?
Well, so what do we do with the blood? I mean, blood in the Jewish tradition in particular is something that's dangerous to shed. It's arguably the reason the flood happened. There are murders prior to the flood experience, so what does God do? God cleans things. How do you clean things? You wash them. Which eventually leads to Levitical codes that deal with very prescribed ways to deal with blood. Some blood you get sacrificed to God, some blood means you're exiled from the community for a while. Which is really what the woman is also done. She's in exile because she's bleeding. And so Jesus then is bringing in from the outside this marginalized body.
The other interesting little side story is that the healthcare system of that day is evidently no better than it is today. Spent a lot of money, and it still wasn't fixed. Interesting.
It's not a theological thought for me, but maybe more of just a personal, parental thought. But I'm always moved by that story that he calls her little girl, because I think the fact that they name her specifically at 12 does point out to me that she is on at least the beginning of puberty. And culturally for that time, and pretty much for all cultures, it's like that all of a sudden puts her in a world of being subject to being called unclean, to subject to being preyed upon, subject to being married off, and losing all of the power that comes to little girls naturally as a child. And so the fact that he calls her of something fairly intimate and something that's still true, that he's still her child, even though her world will be changing
radically,
moving to me.
That's great, and a whole social dimension behind it.
That's why I'm moved that they feed her. And that's, you know, in Mark, the Gospel of John is so Eucharistic when there's feeding, you can think the meal. And Mark, it's sparer, but there is this sense of the house, Jairus' house, and a church, a small church group gathering to worship in the house, and the Eucharist being part of that, and that that the story ends, and they fed her, and I have been hearing that more and more Eucharistically, that this she's brought into this Eucharistic meal, and as she's becoming a woman now, and all these things that you said, there's this meal that will sustain her and keep her, be the food of life for her.
Those who have been raised eating together.
Eating together, yeah.
Which also goes back to your earlier point about Lazarus and the communal dimensions.
Yeah. And I kind of wonder if the bleeding woman wasn't at the house. Just joining those two stories together. That's a big imaginative leap, but
that's the joy of these stories.
Picture her around that table.
Joy of these stories. Well, I see we're about done. But I do encourage you to wrestle with some of these questions about what does it mean to be a Christian body? What are the stories that we tell through our bodies and the way we use them? One way to think about that further is to attend Cato's sessions. What time are you attending?
Tonight in the bottom of Chalet 2, and we're going to look at some contemporary texts about bodies too, but these will kind of be just background, and some of the questions that have been asked will be kind of figured into some writing prompts too. Write and think about it.
Well, I thank you for your time, and go be embodied.